Okay, Google. What's the mileage from California to New York?
The drive from California to New York is 2,912.9 miles.
And what's the tall... Oh. And okay, Google. What's the tallest building in Taiwan?
According to Wikipedia, Taipei 101 displays the Petronas Towers as the tallest building in the world by 57.3 meters.
Thank you very much. Okay, Google. One more question for you. What's the curvature from New York to California? It don't fit up, no. Okay, Google. What is the curvature from Italy?
Curvature, the fact of being curved or the degree to which something is curved.
Right. Okay, Google. Is the Earth flat?
According to Metro, here 10 proofs that the Earth is actually flat, not round. A lot of people thought the fact that we all fly around in aeroplanes would put pay to flat Earth theory, the idea that our planet is in a sphere, but instead a sort of pancake thing.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think you can very simply classify them as being economic, involved with the developments of large-scale industries, factory production, political, the emergence of ideas and forms of political democracy, an important role for the state. I think they also involve changes in terms of knowledge and ideas, for example, the development of science and rationality.
These changes were called modern because they represented a complete break with the past, a different type of society. Modernity was more than just a set of structural changes. It was also a changed way of thinking about the world.
A modern outlook on the world is, I think, above all influenced by science and technology. It's influenced by the idea of casting light on the world around us. It deliberately sets itself against the past. That's what the idea of being modern means.
Modernity really relates to a set of ideas, a way of understanding the world, which is based on science, objectivity, rather than more traditional ways of looking at the world and understanding the world, which could be more based upon religion.
In pre-modern societies, understanding of the world came from religion, and religious leaders made it clear to people that the things that happened to them were the will of God and not to be questioned. Some things were best left in the darkness. The idea that the order of the world is a result of the laws of God is called a belief in providence. By the 18th century, this religious view of the world was being increasingly challenged. Science was just providing better answers. This challenge to the authority of religion was crystallized in an intellectual movement known as the Enlightenment.
I think the basic idea of the Enlightenment, which is a period of social and political thought of roughly around about the late 18th century, is that in the past, our lives have been driven by dogma, by superstition, by religion, by unthought through beliefs.
The idea was that human beings could use their intellect, could use their reason to explain the world and their position within it. And so it gave rise to notions of scientific understandings of the world, as opposed to earlier, more traditional ways of understanding the world.
It means throwing light on something, and their idea that in the past we lived in a sort of dark ignorance of ourselves, we should throw light on the causes of our own behavior, and we should throw light on the origins of the changes in the natural world around us too.
When talk sucker land softly, I simply get rot or flick the man off me. Fanning salts and seeds while steaming my broccoli. Even the geeks eat the bleed in the marsh. Behold, he's out there, they called it them before them. Toes still tipping up, rolling in the snow. Enclosed in a tomb, now I'm always on the road. 10 holes in the graveyard to weaken for a show. Damn it, and my death is the scene to be. And when I jam, it's like the savage, all the king in me. So no more cameras as I manage from far out your reach. Think of leeches with defeat. The fiend and watch it on screen.
Never take my picture. I threw your rumors in my book. And die. Solitude is
cradle of creation. Maybe we can move the world in time. Solitude is the cradle of creation. Baby, see you in your second life.
Stocked up for me, I roll and rock the beat with awkward steeds for show. Never in a million could they attain my path of rapid ritual concealed in pain. They say God is embedded in all of us, but laziness consumes and you mock any dominus. Pay a lot to portray yourself as honest while scoffing at the hot dish only God's accomplished. Hear me? Souls of us are steel and you give them up at will when the real gets weary. I'm set for the war, praise death. God damn it, hex in the force, forged within. Serious?
Never take my picture. I threw your rumors in my book, yeah.
Took control of the wheel.
And I. Solitude is the cradle of creation. Maybe we can move the world in time. Solitude is the cradle of creation. Baby, see you in your second life. Is the cradle of creation. Maybe we can move the world in time. Solitude is the cradle of creation. Baby, see you in your second life. Solitude is the cradle of creation. Maybe we can move the world in time.
100 years. And if you just start thinking about what has taken place in human history in the last 100 years, science will tell us that we have gone to the moon, that we have counted all the stars, that we've made airplanes and flown them across the world, electricity. How about all three world wars have taken place in the last 100 years? So 4.5 billion is a ton of years, yet the universe is 13.8 billion years old. And to get some even higher numbers, our sun has 100 plus billion like it in our galaxy. Some say 200 billion. And the closest one of those suns to us is 25 trillion miles away. So now we've moved on to trillions, which aren't even close to what we were talking about in just coming up with 4.5 billion years. And to get some even more fantastical numbers, our galaxy is one of 10 trillion galaxies. So believe it or not, they have counted all the stars, and the total number of stars is a 1 and then 29 zeros. That is what they'll have you believe is the number of stars which they've counted. And as Neil deGrasse Tyson says, the great thing about science is it's true, whether you believe it or not. And so this is what you must believe if you believe in science. So what science has done is given itself a nice little cush existence. And you might ask, how did they do this? And really, it wouldn't be too hard if you think about it. Let's say that we all wanted to make people think that they were insignificant, small, and that they didn't matter. You could just go through this step-by-step process. So first, you'd come up with your facts. And then second, you'd tell people that they could either believe in religious nonsense or your proven theories. Next, you start spreading your info. Fourth, you create schools and universities where they teach your facts. Next, you would hire only the teachers who believed in your facts. Number six, you'd create a system of peer review based on submitted papers, but you would only allow those who believe in your facts to review papers and only those who went to your schools. Seven, you would demand diplomas for those to enter into your high priesthood, to become your teachers, to become your scientists, your Bill Nyes, your Neil deGrasses. And then you would teach others to laugh and make fun of anyone who talks about other facts. Then lastly, you make sure that the only people who get funding from the government are people who believe in your theories, your facts, and who are doing further studies to prove your theories and your facts. Must be pretty nice to always be right no matter what, because if you ever get proven wrong, well, the great thing about science is ever-changing. It's the discovery of new things every day and the changing of old theories, except for the ones they tell you are fact. Did I confuse you? Here's some interesting facts from the mouth of the beast. Did I say that? I meant from NASA and science. These aren't my words. These are taken from them. That we've counted all the stars and that we know all the distances to those stars. That humans can distinguish between a trillion smells. Remember real quick that science must be tested, must be proven, must be experimented on. Just remember those things. That everything in your body is from exploding stars. That every atom in your body is billions of years old. That the universe might itself be a hologram. That the dung beetle uses the Milky Way to navigate. That we've found 1,000 planets outside of our solar system in the past 20 years. That there is a planet where it rains glass sideways. Again, look up the definition of the scientific method. Come back to this video and hear my voice again. There is a planet where it rains glass sideways. They have found a tiny crystal of zircon, 4.4 billion years old. Remember that you cannot date rocks, by the way. It takes a photon 170,000 years to travel from the core of the sun to the surface, and then it takes 8 minutes from the sun to your eyes. Might want to rewind that and hear that again. How about this one? Our first ancestor, the Tiktaalik fish, was our first ancestor fish that climbed out of the water to live on 4 feet.
Forming four corners of paranormal, get joined for a thermos and parathermals in a warehouse. Air wears Barry Curdle, St. Vincent de Paul trying to square the circle. Circle the source of his power. Foresight born at the corner of Howard on sale. Cherry pick blue in the pail. It's a blue nose chewing his tail. Losing his coat. Schmoozing a high in a head rush. Hack up vial over H1N1 and then some. One eye on the breadcrumbs. Other eye on the drink crumb. Other eye on the income. Good knife in the grin. Shoot dice with the lice and the ringworms. Peg leg. Smells like Medellin. Wake in the night. Make a pipe out of anything. Take five. Take a dive in the celebrate. Turn five in a 5, 6, 7, 8. Back out. Black out somewhere. Fancy shake in the backseat of Aesop's Camry. Dude. Seat for the chips and sandwich meat from the crypt in the end. If you give an address and a rib or a piss, don't question a mystery fish. Just picture shrimp on a pillow with grits. Close your eyes, lick your lips. I'm at the cafe ordering a cup of fresh. Sarah gave me two, I gave one to Rex. He said fools ain't fish plus fuck the pigs. They can never understand what Sumner is.
Word up, word up. Word up.
I'm off grid, I'm through the gate. I fly these kites into the fray.
Word up, word up. Word up.
I'm out the box, I'm through the bud. I fly these kites into the cut.
NorCal fried bacteria. No ID, survived the vivarium. Trisophial, serotonin, and heroin. Eat with the chimera, fly with the seraph. I might hold court with the cats and dogs. It won't cool like an orb in a dragon's claw. And Terry cloth robes outside, detox surly. Curse at a beat cop, doctor is slurpy. And not no Xerxes, paranormal and man. Stay true like a wolf wearing wolf pants. Ooh, never could avoid himself for long enough to contain or employ his help. And now we look both ways at the asteroid belt. Buzzed, gross, and holy gun love. Still hear an X in his head yelling kiss the ring. From a fortune, a fisher king. Or from a sister care, blisters. In his hair, new day, new diarrhea, disrepair. Soup's on two tongue, who's a fix to bear? No shoes, no shirt, no fiscal year. I said hello to Marshall, every morning for six. He yelled at me every time, that's a Maury bitch. It only took one tooth to crack the bug, juice to chug. Turn a bum to a sun, to a bug. Outside home, it's an open swim. Occultism in the throes, a corrosive wind. A cold meal with the ghost of friends. A whole host of meds, a deal on its own, no cassette. I stepped over a body in the door. I pretend he's asleep, but it's probably war. Goddamn, profound apathy, heart with a crack. I'm ships in the night, I'm darts at a mat. Word up.
There are 2 pints of water in every cubic foot of soil on Mars. That atoms that make up a human body are mostly made of empty space. And if you remove all the empty space from the atoms, that make up all the humans on Earth, the remaining mass would fit in a sugar cube. Rewind that one too. In the history of the world, we are closer to Tyrannosaurus Rex than the Tyrannosaurus Rex is to Stegosaurus. That the cost of a spacesuit is $11 million. That the Drake equation says there are millions of civilizations in our galaxy. How about the sun travels in an orbit around our galaxy once every 200 million years? If you fell into a black hole, you'd stretch like spaghetti. Again, these are testable and proven, even though they've never seen a black hole. Those are just some of the amazing facts given to us by the scientists at NASA and all across the world, and I call bullish. But these are things that science says if you don't believe, you're a moron. If you don't believe we went to the moon, you're a moron. If you don't believe that the Earth's been here 4.5 billion years, you're a moron. Well, I'm here to say, here and now, my name is Jaren, and I am a moron. So I gotta ask, who's coming with me?
If anybody else wants to come with me, this moment will be the moment of something real and fun and inspiring in this God-forsaken business, and we will do it together. Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me? This is embarrassing.
I'll leave you with some quotes. You cannot be both sane and well-educated and disbelieve in evolution. The evidence is so strong that any sane, educated person has got to believe in evolution. Richard Dawkins. I'm often asked whether I believe in global warming. I now just reply with the question, do you believe in gravity? Neil deGrasse Tyson. The most complex object in the known universe, the brain, only uses 20 watts of power. It would require a nuclear power plant to energize a computer the size of a city block to mimic your brain. So if someone calls you a dim bulb, that's a compliment. Michio Kaku. One of the saddest lessons in history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle. We're no longer interested in finding out the truth. The bamboozle has captured us. It's simply too painful to acknowledge, even to ourselves, that we've been taken. Once you give a charlatan power over you, you almost never get it back. So the old bamboozles tend to persist as new ones rise. Carl Sagan. Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way. Christopher Hitchens. Nature is a source of truth. Experience does not ever err. It is only your judgment that errs in promising itself results which are not caused by your experiments. Leonardo da Vinci. Governments don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. That is against their interests. They want obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork, and just dumb enough to passively accept it. George Carlin.
Worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for the daily races, going nowhere, going nowhere. Their tears are filling up their glasses, no expression. No expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I
funny, I find it kinda sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Good. Happy birthday, happy birthday. Wanna live the way that every child should. Sit and listen, sit and listen. Went to school and I was very nervous. No one knew. Tell me what's my lesson. Look right through me, look right through me. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. Run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Watching you.
Want to rule? Do you see the problems in your country and know how to fix them? If only you had the power to do so. Well, you've come to the right place. But before we begin this lesson in political power, ask yourself, why don't rulers see as clearly as you, instead acting in such selfish, self-destructive, short-sighted ways? Are they stupid, these most powerful people in the world, or is it something else? The throne looks omnipotent from afar, but it is not as it seems. Take the throne to act, and the throne acts upon you. Accept that, or turn back now, before we discuss the rules for rulers. No matter how bright the rays of any sun king, no man rules alone. A king can't build roads alone, can't enforce laws alone, can't defend the nation or himself alone. The power of a king is not to act, but to get others to act on his behalf, using the treasure in his vaults. A king needs an army and someone to run it, treasure and someone to collect it, law and someone to enforce it. The individuals needed to make the necessary things happen are the king's keys to power. All the changes you wish to make are but thoughts in your head if the keys will not follow your commands. In a dictatorship where might makes right, the number of keys to power is small, perhaps only a dozen generals, bureaucrats, and regional leaders. Sway them to your side and the power to rule is yours, but never forget, displease them and they will replace you. Now, all countries lie on a spectrum, from those where the ruler needs few key supporters to those where the ruler needs many. This foundation of power is why countries are different. Yet many keys or few, the rules are the same. First, get the key supporters on your side. With them, you have the power to act. You have everything. Without them, you have nothing. Now, in order to keep those keys to power, you must, second, control the treasure. You must make sure your treasure is raised and distributed to you for all your hard work and to the keys needed to keep your position. This is your true work as a ruler, figuring out how best to raise and distribute resources so as not to topple the house of cards upon which your throne sits. Now, you, aspiring, benevolent dictator, may want to help your citizens, but your control of the treasure is what attracts rivals. So you must keep those keys loyal. But there's only so much treasure in your vaults, so much wealth your kingdom produces. So beware. every bit of treasure spent on citizens is treasure not spent on loyalty. Thus, doing the right thing, spending the wealth of the nation on the citizens of the nation, hands a tool of power acquisition to your rivals. Treasure poured into roads and universities and hospitals is treasure a rival can promise to key supporters if only they switch sides. Benevolent dictators can spend their take on the citizens, but the keys must get their rewards, for even if you have gathered the most loyal, angelic supporters, they have the same problem as you, just one level down. Being a key to power is a position of power. They too must watch out for rivals from below or above. Thus, the treasure they get must also be spent to maintain their position. The loyal and dim may stay by your side no matter what, but smart key supporters will always watch the balance of power, ready to change allegiance if you look to be the loser in a shifting web of alliances. In countries where the keys are few, the rewards are great, and when violence rules, the most ruthless are attracted, and angels that build good works will lose to devils that don't. So buy all the loyalty you can, because loyalty in dictatorial organizations of all kinds is everything. For the ruler, anyway. Thus, the dictatorship exposed. A king who needs his court to raise the treasure to keep the court loyal and keep raising the treasure. This is the self-sustaining core of power. All outside is secondary. Now, a king with many key supporters has real problems. Not just their expense, but also their competing needs and rivalries are difficult to balance. The more complicated the social and financial web between them all, the more able a rival is to sway a critical mass. The more key supporters a ruler has on average, the shorter their reign. Which brings us to the third rule for rulers. Minimize key supporters. If a key in your court becomes unnecessary, his skills no longer required, you must kick him out. After a successful coup, the new dictator will purge some of those who helped him come to power while working with the underlings of the previous dictator, which from the outside seems a terrible idea. Why abandon your fellow revolutionaries? Are the old dictator's supporters not a danger? But the keys necessary to gain power are not the same as those needed to keep it. Having someone on the payroll who was vital in the past but useless now is the same as spending money on the citizens. Treasure wasted on the irrelevant. And by definition, a dictator that pulls off a coup has promised greater treasure to those switching sides. The size of the vault has not changed, so the treasure must be split among fewer. A dictator that sways the right keys, takes control of the treasure, cuts unnecessary spending, kills unnecessary keys, will have a long and successful career. Seeing the structure unveiled, you might be excited to get started and control a country to the benefit of you and your cronies, or you might be exhausted, wishing to do good but seeing the structural difficulties. Now turn to democracy for salvation. So let us discuss rulers as representatives. You again might have grand dreams of the utopia you wish to build, but no man rules alone, and never more so than in democracy. Presidents and prime ministers must negotiate with their senates and parliaments and vice versa, and they all have their own key supporters to manage. In a well-designed democracy, power is fractured among many and is taken not with force, but with words, meaning you must get thousands or millions of citizens to, if not like you on election day, at least like you better than the alternative. With so many voters and such fractured power, it's impossible to, as a dictator would, follow these rules and buy loyalty. Or is it? Of course not. Don't think of citizens as individuals with their individual desires, but instead as divided into blocks. The elderly or homeowners or business owners or the poor. Blocks you can reward as a group. Democracies have wildly complicated tax codes and laws, not as accident, but as reward for the blocks that get and keep the ruling representatives in power. Farming subsidies, for example, have nothing to do with the food a nation needs, but entirely with how key the vote of the farming bloc is. Countries where farmers' votes don't swing elections don't have farming subsidies. If a bloc doesn't vote, such as younger citizens, then no need to divert rewards their way. Even if large in number, they are irrelevant to gaining power. Which is good news for you. One less block to sway, and the treasure you give your key blocks has to come from somewhere. If you want long years in office, Rule 3 is your friend in a democracy just as much as a dictatorship. You can't eliminate those who don't vote for you, but there is still much you can do. Once in power, make it easier for your key blocks to vote and harder for others. Establish voting systems that reduce the number of blocks you need to win, the more rivals you get. Very handy indeed. Draw election borders to predetermine the results for you or your cronies, and have party pre-elections with Byzantine rules to determine who blocks even can vote for. Mix and match the above for even better power perpetuation. When approval ratings couldn't be lower, yet re-election rates couldn't be higher, you'll know you've succeeded. Now, enough with thinking about the citizens. Even in a democracy, there still are very influential individual key supporters you need on your side, because their money or influence or favors keeps you in power. While you can't just promise to give them treasure directly, as a dictator would, you can create loopholes for their investments, pass laws that they've written, or print get-out-of-jail-free cards for their actions. Not a wheelbarrow of gold to the door, but contracts for their business. You, as a ruler, do have roads to build, or computers to maintain, or buildings to reconstruct. No man rules alone, after all. Or you could take the moral path and ignore the big keys, but you'll fight against those who didn't. Good luck with that. Corruption is not some kind of petty crime, but rather a tool of power in democracies and dictatorships. But more on that another time. So accept the favors, sway the key blocks, and you will get into power, ruling with actions that look contradictory and stupid to those who don't understand the game, privately helping a powerful industry you publicly denounced, or passing laws that hurt a bloc that voted for you. But your job isn't to have a consistent, understandable ruling policy, but to balance the interests of your keys to power, big and small. That is how you stay in office. Now, with all this headache of being a representative, you may wonder, looking at Rule 3, why couldn't you skip all this block-building, favor-trading nonsense and just bribe the army to take power? We must finally turn to taxes and revolts. You must understand Rule 2 and how the treasure is raised and used to hold a country together. If we graph the tax rate of countries versus the number of key supporters the ruler needs, there's a clear relationship. More democracy, lower taxes. If you're sitting comfortably in a cushy democracy, you may scoff at this, but your fellow citizens who don't earn enough don't pay income taxes and get rebates, bringing the average tax rate down. In dictatorships, this doesn't happen. Dictatorships often forego tax paperwork in favor of just taking wealth directly. It's common for the dictator to force farmers to sell their produce to him for little, then turn around and sell it on the open market, pocketing the difference at an unthinkably high equivalent tax rate. So taxes in democracies are low in comparison to dictatorships. But why do representatives lower their take? Well, cutting taxes is a crowd pleaser. Dictators have no need to please the crowds and thus can take a large percentage from their poor citizens to pay key supporters. But representatives in a democracy can take a smaller percentage from each to pay their key supporters because their educated, freer citizens are more productive than peasants. For rulers in a democracy, the more productivity, the better, which is why they build universities and hospitals and roads and grant freedoms, not just out of the goodness of their hearts, but because it increases citizen productiveness, which increases treasure for the ruler and their key supporters, even when a lower percentage is taken. Democracies are better places to live than dictatorships, not because representatives are better people, but because their needs happen to be aligned with a large portion of the population. The things that make citizens more productive also make their lives better. Representatives want everyone productive, so everyone gets highways. The worst dictators are those whose incentives are aligned with the fewest citizens, those who have the fewest keys to power. This explains why the worst dictatorships have something in common: gold or oil or diamonds or similar. If the wealth of a nation is mostly dug out of the ground, it's a terrible place to live because a gold mine can run with dying slaves and still produce great treasure. Oil is harder, but luckily foreign companies can extract and refine it without any citizen involvement. With citizens outside this cycle, they can be ignored while the ruler is rewarded and the keys to power kept loyal. Thus, we live in a world where the best, smartest democracies are stable, the worst, richest dictatorships are stable, and in between is a valley of revolution. The resource-rich dictators build roads only from their ports to their resources and from their palace to the airport, and the people stay quiet not because this is fine or even because they're scared, but because the cold truth is starving, disconnected illiterates don't make good revolutionaries. Now, a middling dictator without resources must, as mentioned before, take a large amount of wealth directly from his poor farmers and factory workers. Thus, two roads won't do, and so he must maintain some minimums of life for the citizens. But keeping the workforce somewhat connected and somewhat educated and somewhat healthy makes them more able to revolt. Now understand, the romantic image of the people storming the gates and overthrowing their dictator is mostly a fantasy. If you run a middling dictatorship, the people only storm the palace when the army lets them to remove you because you lost control over your keys and are being replaced. This is why, after popular revolts in middling dictatorships, the new ruler is often the same as the old, if not worse. The people didn't replace the king, the court replaced the king, using the people's protest they let happen to do it. The very things a benevolent dictator wants to build to cross this valley take treasure away from the keys to power and make the citizens more able to revolt, often ending in a stronger ruler, less likely to build bridges and more loyal to his keys. On the other side, the best democracies are stable, not just because the large number of keys and their competing desires makes dictatorial revolt near impossible to organize, but also because the revolt would destroy the very wealth it intended to capture, the high productivity of the citizens. Plus, those helping the would-be dictator in a democracy know he plans to cull key supporters once in power. That's what a coup is. So potential key supporters must weigh the probability of surviving the cull and getting the rewards versus the risk of being on the outside of a dictatorship they helped create. In a stable democracy, that's a terrible gamble. Maybe you'll be incredibly wealthy, but probably you'll be dead and have made the lives of everyone you know worse. The math says no. Being on the right side of a coup in a dictatorship means having the resources to get you and your family what the peasants lack: healthcare, education, quality of life. This is what makes the competition for power so fierce. But in a democracy, most already have these things, so why risk it? So the more the wealth of a nation comes from the productive citizens of the nation, the more the power gets spread out and the more the ruler must maintain the quality of life for those citizens. The less. Now, if a stable democracy becomes very poor, or if a resource that dwarfs the productivity of the citizens is found, the odds of this gamble change and make it more possible for a small group to seize power. Because if the current quality of life is terrible, or the wealth not dependent on the citizens, coups are worth the risk. When democracies fall, these are usually the reasons. These rules for rulers explain not only why some men are monsters and others are merciful, but everything about politics, from war to foreign aid to political dynasties to corruption, all of which we can talk about at another time. But for now, you, aspiring ruler, may be disgusted by the world of politics and have decided to avoid it entirely. But you cannot, for rulers come in many forms. Yes, kings, presidents, and prime ministers, but also deans, dons, mayors, chairs, chiefs. These rules apply to all and explain their actions. From the CEO of the largest global corporate conglomerate who must keep his board happy to the chair of the smallest homeowners association, managing votes and spending membership fees. You cannot escape structures of power. You can only turn a blind eye to understanding them. And if you ever want the change you dream about, there's a zeroth rule you cannot ignore. Without power, you can affect nothing. You may not like these rules, but surely better you on the throne than someone else. And who knows, maybe you'll be different.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
Keep your eyes peeled, churchies.
As far as I'm concerned, I've had enough of science. I've had enough of all this doctors and PhDs. I know what's going on here. We've been lied to, and I mean big time.
We'll be right back.
many different paths that lead to this particular rabbit hole. And it begins when one begins asking questions with regards to what we've been told our entire lives about religion, about politics, about the media, about education, about everything we've been told about the origin of the human race, about our cosmology. So when you ask questions and you don't give up, when you don't have those answers forthcoming, but you keep digging and digging, eventually you do arrive at the reality of the fact that our governments lie every day, that the media promulgates narratives over fact, that the histories have been distorted, that the maps do not represent reality, and that the major political parties are, for the most part, controlled by or heavily influenced by the interests of world government. And so I get a number of comments from people saying, don't be divisive, you know, why can't we all just agree the world's flat and that should be enough? And that's exactly the kind of thinking we ought to avoid. You see, it was consensus over truth which triumphed. You see, when you allow consensus to replace truth, you end up on a spinning ball floating in the middle of an infinite abyss. You cannot allow the desire to have everyone agree with you and like you replace truth. There are certain lines that you have to acknowledge exist, and here are a couple of facts, a couple of salient points to be made. If you're through with the lies, if you're done with the manipulation, you do have to choose sides. One, you're choosing the side of truth over delusion, over propaganda. So you've already taken a side. When you've gone the way of flat earth, you've already left the side of the ballers. Okay? And then let's go a step further. If you recognize that your freedom lies in moving away from the centralized authority of world government, the cornerstone of which is the belief in global warming, when you step away from that, well then you have to acknowledge your interests do not lie with globalism or global warming or the belief that man causes the world to destruct or the belief that man is poisonous and bad for the environment and is going to cause the world to overheat and kill all life. If you buy into that, that is an apocalyptic religious belief, not scientific. So, to be a flat earther, you have to reject global warming, to be consistent, and to not be acting against the interests of flat earth. No one wants to preserve the delusion of the globe more than Al Gore. And if you agree with his apocalyptic scenario, and you think it's going to happen, and that the government should act to stop it from happening, then you're on his side. You might as well get off the flat earth and focus on saving the ball, because that's what you're advocating. Okay, let's go on from there. Part of flat earth is this idea that we should be free, that we should be allowed to discover what's actually here and what's being kept from us. And part of that is the ability to move at will. Well, let's just be honest here. It's not the citizens of North Korea that are going to figure this thing out and lead the way. It's not the women wearing burqas in Saudi Arabia that are going to make this happen. And it's not going to be led by the mainstream scientific establishment. And it's not going to be led by NASA, whose only purpose is to monopolize space entrepreneurialism, which prevents us from figuring out that not only is space a lie, but if there is anywhere to go, it's straight ahead, not up. To take part in this reformation and this possible new enlightenment, a new age of scientific discovery and technological development, unfettered by the compromised government-controlled science. When we get to the truth of this thing, we have the opportunity to make a better world, but it's not going to happen if you're a communist and you want to repress the activity of the free market. It's not going to happen if you're a gun grabber and you want to give the state more power. Flat Earth is an anti-statist movement. So if you're moving towards centralized power, whether under the guise of saving the planet or taking away weapons, attacking private property rights, if you're on the side of left-wing fascism, go back to the globe, because the globe is a radical authoritarian control system, and it operates through political identity groups. It operates through statism, communism, socialism.
Given how things are with ourselves and the world, one of the great questions we face is, should we laugh or should we cry? The history of philosophy has an interesting take on the choice. Two of the greatest thinkers of ancient Greece were Democritus and Heraclitus. Both men, who lived to a very old age, had a deep knowledge of people and the world, but responded to what they knew in strikingly different ways. Heraclitus couldn't stop weeping. Democritus couldn't stop laughing. It's obvious why Heraclitus cried. Once we open our eyes fully to the reality of existence, it's astonishing we can ever carry on. There is simply so much to be sad about. The human animal is a benighted, deluded, uncontrolled monster, perfectly suited to the error, meanness, and suffering. The greater question is how and why one would ever laugh. There is, of course, always the option of the idiotic laugh, the plastic laugh of the sentimental or callous fool. But this wasn't the philosopher Democritus's way. He laughed richly and generously, not because some privileged position led him to naively misunderstand how bad things could be. His good humor wasn't delusional, nor was it simply a random quirk of temperament. Democritus laughed in a very particular and highly admirable style because of the way he thought about the world. He was a profound realist. He knew everything there is to know about the human tendency to greed, murder, and lust, and of our constant exposure to random accident and misfortune. But ultimately, Democritus was so convinced of the darkness, he knew so much about suffering and risk, he no longer felt he had to register these constantly at the front of his mind in order to do them justice. They seemed to him an entirely obvious baseline fact about existence. He could be cheerful because anything nice, sweet, or charming that came his way was immediately experienced as a bonus, a gratifying addition to an originally bleak starting point. By keeping the dark backdrop of life always in mind, Democritus sharpened his appreciation of whatever stood out against it. A pleasant thing that happened to him wasn't taken to be a feeble compensation for his larger, dashed hopes. It was a delightful, slightly improbable, but very noteworthy bucking of an always expected tragic trend. Democritus was known to have enjoyed parties, wine, and drinking. A life without festivity is a long road without an inn, he wrote. He didn't believe that he had to feel constantly sad to prove that he recognized life to be sad. He danced and drank because of a rightful confidence that he had already done justice and would in the future again have to fully do justice to the sadness of things. Democritus was aiming at an intelligent kind of cheerfulness, one that admits from the outset that life is fundamentally grim, but that uses this despair as a catalyst for a more vivid engagement with the beautiful or kind moments that do come one's way. Like an English person who's especially adept at drawing value from the last day of summer, or a condemned man who perfectly savors the last meal before being led to the firing squad. Democritus was a master practitioner of that highly admirable state of mind, cheerful despair. Once we've acquired the skill of cheerful despair, life acquires a distinctive new kind of sweetness in all its pleasant stretches. Every pain-free day is a blessing. We're amazed and touched when once in a while someone seems to understand a few things we say or does something unexpectedly kind. We enjoy the distinctive cheerfulness of those who've done all the crying they can and are determined, for a while at least, to hold on to the light.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
Angels, they call my name. return from where I came. All of the little sounds call out from sky to ground. Lions up in the snow. Oh, one breath and there we go. One breath and there we go. Teach us all. Oh, grandfather. Oh, grandfather, come and teach us all. Oh, grandfather. Oh, grandfather, come and teach us all. Grandfather, oh grandfather, come and teach us all. Oh grandfather,
now, go find the others.com.
Al's first backflip. You all right, buddy?
Yep, I'm good.
Good?
Yeah, I'm good. No, thanks.
Wow.
I just gotta go bigger.
Gotta go bigger.